You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702.
For the curious.
Live.
Online.
Smartphones.
DSTV.
And 92.7.
And 106 FM.
I think there's a sense in which the conversations that we've just had about how divisive our political discourse in Parliament is and what happened yesterday in particular really is, I think, the perfect backdrop to what I want to focus on in this hour. And there are a range of themes I want to explore with a fantastic guest that you know extremely well. I'll introduce him in a second. And then as you listen to our conversation, I want you to call in and to be part of this conversation. But in a sense, in order to problem solve the biggest issues in our country, be these high levels of unemployment, be it low economic growth, gender-based violence, racism, and a range of other issues that we urgently need to problem solve, it will require of us to strategically cooperate despite our differences. And something that's bothered me now for a while is why we seem unable, and in turn, how will we do better at building cross-class solidarity in South Africa? How do you build a workers' movement, despite ideological personality and other differences between union movements and particular unions and affiliates? How do you strategically cooperate to push back against an uncaring and an unresponsive state, even if you live in different parts of a big city like Johannesburg? It's not to say that your differences go away when you march together or when you jointly pen an important, strongly worded letter to the president. But we don't seem to be very good at learning how to politically, strategically cooperate across our class, racial, ethnic, linguistic, and other kinds of geographical as well, other kinds of differences in our country. And one thing that has caught my attention in recent weeks is the attempt within the trade union movement to do precisely that. Now, we could do a 5-hour radio show on incredibly interesting, deep differences within South African workers' movement after 1994. And yet, despite that, there is now a recognition that something's got to give. That if you are in SAFTU, for example, you've got to be willing to be able to meet with AMCU, for example, and ask not what your differences are, but what are you going to do to protect the rights of workers that are under threat as a result of, say, for example, austerity within the state. And so we're going to be talking about trade unionism and the fate of workers. But for me, the broad conversation this hour is really fundamentally, how do we begin to make cross-class solidarity a South African thing in 2020? Because, my God, we need to be able to learn to cooperate. I cannot think of a better person to have this conversation with than the very experienced person who always has to think strategically and tactically around how do you deal with people that you don't see eye to eye with, keep them on side for purposes of a mutual goal that has got to be achieved, then Zwelinzima Mavavi, who of course is the General Secretary of the South African Federation of Trade Unions, but more than that, someone who is an activist and a trade unionist with many decades of good service to our country. Zwelinzima, thank you so much for making time for us and coming into studio for this really interesting and important conversation, I think.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me for such an important discussion.
Let's start by describing just how bad the situation is that we find ourselves in. You know, when I read ANC and particularly SACP intellectuals, they sometimes describe the state and the state of the nation in ways in which make me think, do we live in the same country? Because they describe it in such complex terms, you would think that all is well, and all we need to do is tinker a little bit here and there, a little bit of plumbing, and South Africa will be as good as an economy in the global north. But that is not the reality, right? We are seriously, seriously in trouble. And it's not anti-democratic to paint a picture of the realities of where we find ourselves in.
Thank you, Eusebius. I think that we are in a precipice. As the country, we have reached in some respects a point of no return. 25 years, soon to be 26 years, has been a disaster in our view for the greater majority of the citizens of the country, particularly the working class, the underclass, and the pauper classes of society. The biggest crisis we face is that of an economy that have not responded to the biggest challenge, which is the crisis of unemployment. And as you know, the face of that crisis is the black youth, and it is the black women, and it is the people that reside in the rural areas, in particular the former bantustans. It is the people who reside in the informal settlements of the big cities and the townships in general. Now, that's our crisis number one in society. But of course, the cousin, sister, brother of that crisis is poverty. The rates of poverty in our country, for a country that is rated amongst the top when it comes to its natural resources, is absolutely frightening. And if you look at, for example, at the statistics that some economists attached to universities are saying, they're saying that no, whereas Statistics South Africa said our poverty have increased to just over 53%.
That's right.
Last time they counted, this was in 2011. No, a guy says no, that it's actually a 63% rate of poverty. If you calculate it on the basis of people who are living on a 900 rands. So, I mean, that's a disaster. If you have a 63% of your population living in dire poverty that dehumiliated them every day, you can imagine what are the social consequences of that. So the social consequences is what you see. The rates at which our youth is trapped in into drugs epidemic. There's a drug epidemic amongst our youth in our country. There is gang wars that are going out of hand in all of the townships, be they black, mainly black, of course. So-called colored and so-called African in particular. If we were to discuss that definition, that's another set of a discussion altogether. So that's our second problem. And unfortunately, 25 years into democracy, South Africa has become even more unequal than we were during the apartheid era.
Now, that is interesting to me because let's take not the 25-year period, but just the last two, 3 years. I thought one of the more effective responses to the State of the Nation address came from Pieter Groenewald. And I know we listen to people's identities rather than their content. The only thing that the man said yesterday that I didn't like ideologically, it's just where I'm at, but that's a different conversation, is that BEE, we need to put a moratorium on it. But then he does something else though, Zweli. Then he says, he just lays out the facts on the indices that you've just used for the 25-year period. But the point I want to make is he does it in relation to the presidency of Cyril Ramaphosa. And he says to him, Mr. Ramaphosa, when you started, your own government on day one was in a year of economic growth over 1%. Now it's been slashed to around 0.7%. On unemployment, the narrow definition, it was around 27%. Now the latest figure is 29.1%. And so he goes on. And he just lays out the facts and he uses sources of agencies that are state agencies. How much of a letdown has Cyril Ramaphosa been? Because he was meant to be, for the ANC at least, the magic wand. And yet the reality is the 25-year trajectory that you are talking about, each one of those graphs are sloping in the wrong direction, even under his watch.
Oh, unfortunately, Pieter Groenewald was correct. And that's the statistics we also using, because we're not even getting them from our propagandist machineries. No, we're getting them from the statistics out of Africa.
Exactly.
unemployment have become worse under the watch of this president. And I know that guys will say, yeah, the people you supported in 2005 and 2009, we've had that discussion, me and you. But unemployment have been going worse in our country from 1994 until to date. There's no letting off in relation to that. It's getting worse. Poverty is getting worse. Inequalities is getting worse. The rates of corruptions are worse than any other time. I don't know the past 2-3 years since he took over. I have not seen any statistics in relation to that. But if you listen to the ministers, if you listen to the Department of Treasury officials, I mean, when they say up to 30% of your procurement budget get stolen is through clever tender rigging, then you must know that society is absolutely stuck in a terrible situation. And I think everybody that would have had a big hope, and we were not amongst those.
But no, here's the thing, right?
We were not amongst those.
I want to ask you where you would situate trade unions, trade union bosses, those in charge on the floors as shop stewards, in your diagnostic in that 25-year period. Because everything you've described so far, for a very informed South African who is dispassionate, even as a fan of Cyril or as a fan of the ANC, they have to agree. The facts are what they are. Our lived experiences plus the hygienic empirical data are all accurately describing how much we are on the precipice, as you put it earlier. But you are lucky in a sense because labor journalism in this country is marginalized, wrongly so, in the mainstream media. And as a result, we don't often hold you as accountable as we should. So let me go in that direction. Aren't you also part of the making of the horror that we are in, broadly, as a trade union sector in this country? Fantastic history in the annals of our fights against apartheid. But after 1994, many an academic, many a good journalist have chronicled the story of how careerism and corporatism within the trade union movement, including the toenadering from the ANC to many within the trade union leadership, have led to a trade union movement that have sometimes sponsored the corruption and the other problems that you have enumerated.
I cannot agree with you more. And in fact, one of the issues that I've been hammering on since my days in COSATU has been exactly this. Look, we're operating within the system of a capitalist society. It is dominated by certain ethos, and its values are those of a dog eat dog, the survival of the fittest, and me first to hell with everybody else. And unfortunately, those values have been spreading across society, into the trade union, into the liberation movements, into every civil society formation. Now even the religious formations are battling with the fake pastors who are taking advantage of the constitution that gives all of us a right to religious beliefs. And what that have meant is that the original values of Chris Hani, Steve Biko, Robert Sobukwe, and Nelson Mandela, which were centered around principally selflessness, the preparedness to even lay down your own life for the common good of society and people that you will never ever meet in your life, that is being eroded. And what is taking over is this. And as a result of that, even the once mightier trade unions have not escaped that. When unions' power increased in the shop floor to hire, to determine who's going to be the service provider for medical aids, for provident fund, or even for the catering companies, that power unfortunately corrupts, and more power corrupts even more, as they say, and before you know it, workers begin to view the trade unions as part of the establishment that is exploiting them. And they revolt against it. In fact, if you look at what happened in Marikana, it was the revolt of mine workers against the system. And unfortunately, in the system, was the biggest union in some point in our country, the National Union of Mine Workers.
That's
and
right.
So they were wiped out together with the management.
Would you agree with me that wiping out, and in general, even for COSATU, that the decimation in terms of your membership figures over time is a kind of, in effect, a referendum on how workers view you?
Absolutely.
And that clearly workers have had, over time since 1994, diminished level of trust associated with union leadership.
The other issue that you mentioned in passing is the issue of the social gap between the leadership of the trade unions. From the shop floor, the shop stewards are provided cell phones, laptops by management, and these are free as part of facilitating a representation of these shop stewards for members.
Mm-hmm.
You move from there up to the general secretary, the gap is wide. We stay in the leafy suburbs, and the people we represent are all in Alexander and other townships, worst of all, the other rural areas that you don't see.
Sure.
And that sometimes affects the degree of consciousness, even amongst the leaders.
Can I ask you, I know it's speculative, but I think it's important to wear an industrial sociology cap for a second. What motivated that gap in conscience between commitment to the cause of workers on the floor, heyday, late 80s, early 90s, and where we are at now? For example, one possibility is simply going back to poverty. When you have been poor, then Smuts's statement come back, not just to you as a politician, but also as a shop steward. I did not struggle to be poor. Why were the sins of incumbency that we routinely associate with the ANC in government and with politicians and political appointees, why did that also sully the trade union movement without justifying the behavior, just to try and understand how that came about?
It came about right in 1994. 1994 was the opening of all opportunities to black people. And so all of a sudden, the former shop steward became the minister, became the deputy president, and became the director general. And the former militant became the hospital manager, and so forth and so forth. And unfortunately, when that happens, those that remain in the trade union somehow compete with their former friends, comrades.
Sure.
At the social level. Which car are you driving? Where do you stay? What salary are you earning? And before the trade union movement knew it, they suddenly were under so much pressure to increase the salaries and conditions of employment of the officials, at least to compete with the government. Otherwise, the unions were risking the massive exodus of experienced and skilled trade union officials to government, which was desperately looking for the best in order to ensure that they sort out issues of demographics in terms of representation. And the unions became under pressure. They increased the salaries. I remember once I was in COSATU, we once got 100% increases. And unfortunately, that started this
becomes addictive.
To the bottom,
yeah,
that we're talking about. In 1997 was the best year for the trade union movement. Unions were representing around 38-40% of the entire workforce. And in 2020, that number has come down to around 23%. Now you can see that the rate at which workers in general have lost hope on the trade unions has been absolutely dramatic in our country. And that's why we keep on saying that we must go back to the basics. And it's not an easy thing. I mean, there's one unionist that keeps on joking about this thing, that whereas SAFTU left COSATU and in big part, precisely because of what we are talking about, but all of a sudden SAFTU itself finds itself in a situation where it may have left with some of the Togoloshes from the past. And these Togoloshes are now right here in amongst us. And threatening to take us exactly back to what we said we were turning our backs to.
The key value that's missing there for me is one that's also missing in mainstream politics or within the party political system and within the state, which is, and we then need to translate the value into behavior and attitudinal changes. And that's accountability, right? Accountability hasn't been entrenched within the South African political system, which is why, as you have famously said over here, we have the cancer of corruption that has been responsible for now the state capture and what we see on TV with the Commission of Inquiry. Hindsight is a perfect science, but looking back over the trade union movement since 1994, what was not in place that could have at least minimized, if not stopped, some sense of incumbency seeping into the trade union movement?
Politics and ideology. We let go. I mean, the trade unions used to be the school where we develop the leaders of society. I mean, if you look at 1994, look at the type of the calibre of leaders that COSATU deployed in the ANC, and they did well as the ministers. We may have not agreed with them ideologically because they found themselves trapped up in a massive class compromise. And
the ANC was good at that game, right? Because once you are inside government, you're also constrained by collective cabinet responsibility, for example.
Absolutely, absolutely. But one thing that makes me at least proud is that there's hardly any of a trade unionist that has gone to parliament and found himself in the Zondo Commission. You can go back to the Jay Naidoos, Alec Ewins, Marcel Goldings, and up to even Cyril. Whatever we can say about the billion rands, which I have condemned him for raising that money, and therefore for killing a possibility of himself standing morally and telling the ANC branches that you shall respect the mandates of your branches. He can never, ever, ever do that. And that's why the ANC is just in a race to the bottom. It can't be saved. If its own president gets trapped up in that, it's over. It's game over.
Before we take
but the point that we're making is that at least with their training and with the ideological and grounding and politics, none of them have been caught up in scandals. Very proud of Ibrahim Patel. Very proud of many others.
I get that. I was going to ask a different question, but let's stay on the politics. I mean, the politics and ideology, so that was absent, right? But it also seems like the other thing that, and we know when the ANC came into power, it wasn't prepared for all of the mechanics, the nuts and bolts of statehood. And part of what had to be learned overnight with the unbanning of the ANC that happened very quickly, and next thing you're in power, is learning the mechanics of governance. So there's politics that needs to happen, but politics is, it's words, it's ideology, it's all that kind of stuff. But you also need processes in place. You need oversight mechanisms. If you are taking money from workers that gets deducted from their salaries, if you are setting up bursary schemes, investment arms, there's an opportunity there for money to be chowed, to be funneled where it shouldn't be funneled. Was the trade union movement properly set up after 1994 for the business of trade unionism in terms of oversight mechanisms?
Immediately after 1994, we set up a commission, which we at COSATU was named after its first deputy president, Connie September. And that commission did an unbelievable work, conducted a series of discussions on various aspects of democracy with the members, and developed scenarios for COSATU, what can happen, what may happen, and to the negative. And that scenario, the worst one, was called the Skorokoro scenario, meaning that the state will not function, will not respond to the plight of the majority. There will be more unemployment. There will be more class compromises that are happening at the expense of workers, and that the trade union movement will find itself irrelevant because it has been trapped into the politics of today, the capitalist order. And so there was some preparation. But every time you can go back to that and read those of those scenarios, and you will see that this is exactly where we are in the Skorogoro scenario that was painted by that commission.
Let's take a break right there. Fascinating. We spend the first half trying to do an analysis of where the unions are at, looking over our shoulder. How did we get to the state that we are in? And I think that the picture that Zwelinde Mavava is painting, both of our economic indices and their social consequences, as well as the trade union movement, is spot on. The question is, where to from here? We can either choose fatalism, or we can learn to strategically cooperate. If we choose the latter, what does it mean practically when there are such interesting, sometimes deep differences between different unions and union movements? Any questions you've got? 011-883-0702. He loves good engagement. Give us a call right now and you can talk to him directly. 011-883-0702.
Eusebius Makaiser
on 702
for the curious.
26 minutes before 11 o'clock and a fascinating conversation. And as well as Emma Vavi is with us, and we're talking about the prospects of strategic cooperation despite our differences. And I want us to have a forward-looking second half of this conversation. Please be part of it. You can see from your tweets, many of you are listening to every single word. You don't have to agree with what he's saying. You can agree and underscore points that are important to underscore. Or maybe you've got your own viewpoints around this question that I'm about to put to him as well. It's a big one and we'll slowly unravel it, which is the beauty of long-form journalism that I get to do mid-morning. And that is, do we have any chance to learn how better to not ignore our differences, but to strategically cooperate despite those differences, with a view to cooperating in the service of achieving goals that are goals that we share? I think that's a really important question for our country. 011-883-0702. Now, there are many differences between the likes of yourself, Ivan, Joseph, many others. And yet, when we look at the fate of workers in this country, you should have many common interests at the same time, whether it be deep income inequality, how value is extracted from, say, a rock drill operator and gets unfairly and disproportionately concentrated in the hands of those who are the owners of capital, to jobs that are being shed, to tough conversations with the Minister of Finance around austerity and its implication for families. Those are real issues, and you speak on it persuasively every time you speak. What I'm fascinated by is, how are you going to cooperate strategically so that capital and power, including state power, doesn't benefit from the differences between you?
There are two things that I think we ought to be doing in our country in relation to the point that you are raising. The first one is to ensure that we reverse the levels of fragmentization of the trade union movement that have meant less power for workers at the socio-economic level, including at the plant level. And it is that absence of power to at least mitigate the worst effects of what we saw in 2008-2009, the second biggest economic crisis visiting our country, that have been so solely missed by society. I mean, anybody who believes in social justice and fairness cannot celebrate the fact that unions used to represent almost 40% in 1997, and suddenly that have come down to about 22-23%. So we need to get a conversation, and we've been trying hard to get that conversation going. I mean, we've been writing letters to the people that have dismissed us unfairly, and that have broken the once mighty, fastest growing trade union movement in the world. And we've been saying, if we can dwell into the past, if we can go to the table and begin to count how many disagreements we have, then we will go nowhere. That's the first level. We've been going back to even other federations like FEDUSA and NACTU to say workers will gain more from a more united, coherent, cohesive worker movement in our country. That's the first point. The second point is that the distance between society that we spoke about also is within the working class. Increasingly, since 1994, there is no solidarity between workers employed and the unemployed workers. And remember, we're almost 40% unemployment rate. When it comes to youth, the more youth is unemployed than those that are employed. We're sitting almost at 60% now, 58%. I mean, that's why we're calling that a precipice. It's a point of no return.
That's such an interesting point. Let's just hold those two points because I want you to say more on each one of them. Let's first come to the first and then the second, and then I'll take Ernest and David. On the first issue, you are describing almost conceptually why it's important to cooperate. I want to know practically, who have you met with? Where are you at? Let's say, for example, the current Minister of Finance comes up with an anti-poor rather than a pro-poor, an anti-worker rather than a pro-poor budget. What does strategic cooperation mean between you and other union movements so that they can feel the full collective might of disgruntled workers?
Last week, we had a joint press conference with AMCU, unprecedented. I mean, we've never cooperated with AMCU, but we have been working on them very slowly for the past 4 or 5 years to say the only future for workers is unity. And we're happy that they're at the point now where at the principal level, they agree to affiliate and to SAFTU and to work with us to address the crisis of austerity, which is going to be hitting the working class and the poor like you can't believe come the 26th of February.
Where that is incredible. Yeah. That is really incredible. It might partly explain also why something that was very strange to me. Joseph Matunjua said to my producer that when you come on this platform, you are speaking also on his behalf on this particular question around cooperation. Obviously, I'm not happy with that. I'd rather have the man speak for himself. But politically, is that part of what you mean by the possibility of being an affiliate?
Yeah. Secondly, we are working on dates now, no longer whether we can or cannot meet with COSATU. We're working on the dates to have a conversation at the 12th aside to make sure that, again, we don't focus on the past. We will never go anywhere. We're not going to say to them, why did
you
endorse Ramaphosa? We're going nowhere in that discussion. Yeah. The point is, what do we do about the job loss bloodbath?
Absolutely.
And what are we going to do about the austerities? Measures that are going to be coming out of the.
I think that's really fascinating. Now let's do the second issue, right? So here's the interesting thing. I often, when I give keynotes, I engage capital on this question because they have an interest in a divided, not just union sector in the country. They also have an interest, capitalists, in divisions between the unemployed and workers who are exploited. And you know this better than me because this is your daily job. It's not mine. I just observe from a distance as a commentator. But what I often see and hear from from those who are controlling the means of production is they love to pit a poorly paid worker against their cousin that is unemployed and make you feel guilty for fighting for the rights, better work conditions, better living wages to be paid, fair wages to be paid. When you put those things on the table for discussion, they make it seem as if you've got a choice. You can either be paid 15,000 rand as a rock drill operator, or your cousin that you're paying black tax to can also be employed for 12,500. How are you thinking through the importance of bringing the unemployed into the fold, even though you literally exist to represent someone who has a job?
Not easy, but it is the only way forward for our country at this moment. There is no strong national unemployed organization in our country. There's fragmentization, even at that level. There is no representation, even at that level. But there are things that are happening. For example, we're now beginning to work with a formation that is called the Unemployed People's Assembly. And interestingly, on Friday, there will be caravans leaving all major cities from Polokwane, Durban, and elsewhere. They are going to rally on Saturday in Bloemfontein on their way to Parliament to protest the fact that they know that the budget that is going to be read by the Minister of Finance is going to be austerity budget. It is going to be celebrated, maybe, because I think that the whole budget is going to be designed to please the rating agencies, IMF and the World Bank, and it is not going to be designed to address the crisis of poverty, inequalities, and unemployment in our society. So they're going to be rallying. We're having a rally and marches in Cape Town on the 26th. We're having rallies and marches in Johannesburg and Durban, everywhere else, to protest against the austerity measures. Now, that cooperation extend more than just the trade unions and the unemployed. What we're trying to build is a broader coalition, what we call a front of the poor.
And that will include the unemployed, the indigent, and the working poor.
Everyone. We're trying to put together the people who are battling against the environmental destruction. We are in the middle of the worst ecological crisis in our country. We're trying to bring those people to work with the people who are in the informal sector, the people who are battling against the evictions in towns. Cape Town is becoming to be a city where not even the middle class can live. We're uniting the what they call the backyarders, the civil society organizations. In Soweto, there will be a big rally on Sunday, people protesting against the indiscriminate disconnection of electricity by Eskom on the basis that they're owing an 18 billion rands, which Eskom cannot explain.
Absolutely.
How it arrived at 18 billion, because most of that money is owned by the small industries surrounding Soweto. So there will be a massive rally at Togoza Park on Sunday. We're trying to work with everybody. But more importantly, the Soweto Initiative is going to break one of my biggest concerns. This thing that there is African black people with concerns that are separate from their comrades and sisters, brothers in the so-called colored township is something that we want to consciously break down in 2020. And the Soweto rally, you will see, will bring in loads and loads of activists from Eldorado Park. And once we crack it in the south, including bringing people from the Nishia, we will be able to crack it everywhere else and have a unity of the working class, not based on any race or prejudice
or employment status
or even employment status. And that's exactly where we think we will go in 2020.
Fascinating. Really, put on your headphones for me. Let's take one call before we take a break. Ernest, thank you for listening closely and also for your patience. Have you got a question, a thought?
Good morning, CDF man, your visitor. Yeah, thank you very much for this topic. Very intriguing, and just as a concerned citizen, you know, I feel that, you know, we've been far marginalized as the people that are not within the unions. To have, you know, a platform to communicate with them and, you know, to be in solidarity with them in, you know, battles such as this one where, you know, we see our country is sliding down. And, you know, there isn't a way that we can actually have one voice and say, look, we are not happy with how things are going, be it anywhere from parliament to all the aspects, you know, everything that is happening in civil society. So I just need to ask him, is there a way that they can work out a framework where, you know, we can, it can be very easy to be, you know, in a forum. Where we can, you know, come up from different, like you said earlier on, that we have to be able to work out our differences and forget about the differences we have. What is it that brings us together as citizens of this country?
Absolutely. Beautiful. Thanks, Ernest. David, your question?
Good morning to the both of you. The point that I wanted to make specifically is that We need to especially make sure that there is our workplaces, and our country doesn't have enough industry, bottom line. The only way an economy can grow is by people being employed, and the only people that can employ masses and masses of people would be private businesses. Now, I'm a civil servant, and I work in the education space. And it's no good that we align our curriculum with nothing, because the kids that have come through will be educated to do nothing simply because there's no job.
Absolutely. That's so true. I want to add on to David's question and slightly redirect it. We'll take a break and then respond to both of these calls. Isn't it easier, if someone was playing devil's advocate, they might say, to critique how horrible capital is, tell the mine owners, tell the farmers to pay better wages, etc., etc., organize a, you know, multiracial movement in Soweto to put pressure on the government. But if you were in government, Zweli, what did you do about the reality that there are deep structural reasons that explain the state of the economy? The economy is growing at 0.7% per annum. How on earth will you have an opportunity to create employment, let alone both creating employment opportunities and also be in a position to reduce income inequality?
Eusebius Makaiser.
Eusebius Makaiser.
On 702.
So the first question was interesting. I think you've partly answered it with your description of what can happen in, for example, Soweto, where everyone can arrive and recognize there's an issue around which the community can galvanize. But there is often a broader sense amongst citizens of how do I get involved? Where is my opportunity? Unions exist for certain sectors of society, and the average Joe, all they're left with is to write a strongly worded letter to the Star or to complain on the 702 open line.
Yeah. We convened a what we called a working class summit in July of 2018. Mm. 147 organizations attended. And we know that we touched just the surface. And we're convening another one on the 6th of March. And we're inviting again all of these working class formations, don't tell me about where they're coming from, to come and be part of the conversations to answer a question. How do we make sure that we end working in silos? Mm. How do we coordinate? But more importantly, what is that we must do to make sure that the government change its economic framework? And we believe that the current economic framework at the structural level simply reproduces unemployment, poverty, and inequalities, and nobody can debate with us anymore. We've had 25 years of neoliberalism, now of austerity, that is absolutely biting. And believe me, the 26th of February will represent the worst kind of attacks on the living standards of the poor in this country. We may even see another VAT increase. That's the speculation now. And we'll see even more what they call sin taxes. And yet the taxes of the corporates will definitely not be touched. They will remain low in comparison to the international standards and the people we compete with. So we're going to be asked to resolve the crisis of capitalism. It's going to be solved at the back of even greater levels of deprivation and poverty. So we're meeting on the 6th of March, and we have to have a framework, because look, when you open a window, the Chinese says what comes in is not only fresh air, but mosquitoes as well. And we need to make sure that we do not have too many mosquitoes in the house that can dilute even the purpose of coordinating as the working class and the poor communities.
We only have two minutes. I want you to spend it on the last caller's call. He asked about education, but I want to ask it more broadly. I mean, it's easy to describe the state, and it's important to do so, right? Because the state wields enormous power, the same with capital. But I do wonder what you think the state at a strategic level, the details require a full hour conversation on its own, but at least in terms of posture and orientation, what should this government be doing differently? I mean, the economy is growing at less than 1%. There are, as you've just described yourself, deep structural weaknesses and problems with the economy. It's extremely hard for the economic cluster to simply accede to the demands of the workers' movement under the current conditions.
Let me just talk one issue of cooperation before answering your question.
Sure.
We started to have a conversation with what we, in South Africa is called the manufacturing cycle, which is the organization of the bosses in our country, because they have a concern which we share that South Africa is deindustrializing at such a rate that we're going to find ourselves with no industry to boast with, in no time. And so we started to cooperation. We're now in a process of developing a comprehensive strategy of a much more deeper cooperation, promotion of local industry at a local level with the cooperation of each and every local government. For example, we're trying to do something big about tomato. We can't believe that South Africa exports 70% of its tin stuff from Europe, particularly Italy. And yet we are the home of vegetables in Limpopo. So we're looking at how we can cooperate and make sure that we rope in the local players to make sense of that, but also popularizing that concept at the national level for people to be inspired that South Africa can industrialize again, can build its manufacturing sector again, and therefore can create jobs that will give workers a little bit of a decent wage. Now, here's our structural problem. Our biggest structural problem is that we have things that we're not, we're scared to address. The first thing we're scared to address is to unravel the fact that our economy remains so dominated by the minerals, by the finance, and by the heavy chemicals. We have not used the advantages we have of being a home of the mineral deposits to build secondary industries. We've spoken about beneficiations. It's happening now, but not at a scale that can reverse the trends of industrialization.
Sure.
We've given away some of our competitive advantages. We sold ISCO when we needed a steel industry in South Africa to do a proper reconstruction and development, to build houses, to build bridges, and to build infrastructure. We should have not sold ISCO because we should have needed those fertilizer to build a agricultural sector that will be supported decisively by the state in order to support small, medium, macro enterprises, people who are entering the space of agriculture. We should have sorted the education at this level. We should be competing with Zimbabwe and Zimbabwe at the minimum.
Absolutely.
We should have sorted the healthcare. We should have sorted many structural issues. We should have sorted the capacity of the state. One of my criticisms about the state is that currently we don't know how to do both good and bad. We're just in the middle of a crisis, zigzagging and going nowhere. And that's why we keep on reproducing the crisis we inherited from the apartheid era.
Absolutely. So Lindsay Mavavi is, of course, General Secretary of the South African Federation of Trade Unions. Fascinating and incisive contribution this hour. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you very much, Yusuf, for having me.